When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of You're Wrong with Molly Hemingway and David Harsanyi. You know, Molly, some weeks I really worry that we're not going to have enough to talk about, you know, and this, I think, might be one of those weeks, don't you?
Yeah, nothing really is going on in the world at large, the country.
The country is not falling apart. Anyway, let's talk about the Durham report. That is the news of the day, but apparently not the news for mainstream. Oh, for establishment media, where it was barely covered, including, I'm sad to say, in the Wall Street Journal on the initial day, though they had a very good editorial later about it. Obviously, this is something you've covered. I mean, the topic of Russia collusion, the hoax of Russia collusion from nearly the very beginning. I think the Federalist deserves credit for being onto this very early and writing just a slew of really good stories and great journalism. But I'll just start with this because I don't know how else to get into this huge topic. Was there anything in that report that surprised you or anything that you didn't expect? Or was it exactly what you expected?
So I think I might have had a better understanding of what to expect than a lot of people did. So the report in some ways was exactly what I expected. A really thoughtful, precise look at how the Russia collusion hoax got weaponized by the FBI. And it is that. But having said that, there are lots of surprises for me, including, I mean, like one of the things that Durham explains is that there were multiple disconcerting issues surrounding foreign attempts to bribe Hillary Clinton. And the way the FBI handled that was either to sort of not worry about it or to give a defensive briefing, certainly not to open up an investigation. In one case, they actually tell a confidential human source that they don't want that source continuing to give information about foreign attempts to give money to the Clinton campaign. So there were lots of interesting details about that that I had no idea about. And even, I think it's largely surmised that one of these incidents involves a guy who had been publicly saying that he had been an FBI confidential human source put against the Clinton campaign. It's this Overstock CEO, Patrick Byrne. And I think a lot of people just kind of dismissed what he was saying. And then it looks like he might have been telling the truth about parts of this because it's in the Durham report. So there's a lot of stuff that would be like any journalist who has a pulse has a lot to look at here. And I've been doing a real close read. I mean, I did that thing everybody does of getting the report, reading the executive summary, going through, like sort of skimming the rest. But now I and also Margot Cleveland and a few other reporters at the Federalist, we're doing like a real careful look. And there's a lot in there that's very interesting to me.
So for me, at least, just reading through it very quickly, and I haven't taken a deep dive. And honestly, people who have been paying attention to every aspect of the story can contextualize it much better than I can, you know, but still, it is such a disheartening thing to read. I'm not even exaggerating here when I say that I feel like this is the last like nail in the coffin for me. Like, I feel like we can't survive. And not only because we have the FBI and all these, you know, really powerful people coordinating attacks and being involved in this conspiracy to undermine an election. It's that no one cares. That I became a journalist because I thought, like, you know, journalists stand up to people in power, journalists defend freedom, all these things, but we have nothing. And now obviously many of these journalists who involved themselves in this were credulous and many of them were devious. But after reading this report, it seems to me like most of them were probably devious and few of them were actually just dupes. Do you know what I mean? Or they were willing dupes because they knew that this was just incredibly thin. Like, to me, it seems like there was dispositive evidence that the FBI ignored, not just like not enough evidence, that there was actually evidence that they were spreading Russian or tracking down Russian disinformation. Am I wrong about this?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that.
What I mean is that the FBI should not only have not pursued this investigation because they didn't have enough evidence, but that they had evidence that proved that it would have been a bad thing to pursue in the first place.
Okay, you know, so yeah, this is actually one of the really interesting parts of the Durham report. And I just want to make a real quick point that one of the things I find disheartening is how many people opine on what's in the report without actually having read it. It's quite obvious that a lot of these corrupt propagandists who are like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. They clearly have not read it. In some cases, they're mentioned by name for their wrongdoing, and yet they're going out on major media and saying there's nothing there. But so one of the things that Durham looks into is the fact that by the end of July, U.S. intelligence knew that Russians were talking about Hillary Clinton personally approving a plan to say that Donald Trump was an agent of Putin. Now, the reason why that's significant is because everything that they got related to this should have been viewed through the lens of, is this real or is this a Hillary Clinton operation? And we found out, you know, a year or 2 years later that Hillary Clinton had personally paid for the operation to create the Steele dossier with her campaign, along with the DNC. So it was like they actually purchased the Steele dossier. But even before we knew that conclusively, a smart FBI would have thought, gosh, this seems like kind of what we heard the Russians seem to know about what Hillary is doing. And Durham lays out everything. He's like, so supposedly the Russians said, like, on this day in July, Hillary Clinton personally approved the plan. We asked her about it and she said, no, I never personally approved a plan like that. That's crazy. But Durham points out that the very next day, there are emails from top foreign policy advisors trying to get this whole thing going. And then he talks about what's happening in July, what's happening in August, what's happening in September, what's happening in October. And he actually points out that on one day, October 30th, 2016, multiple stories dropped. Alpha Bank, the Russia investigation at the FBI, Christopher Steele being really concerned about Russia collusion with the Trump campaign. They all dropped on the same day. Hillary Clinton put it at the top of her Twitter feed that this was like a real thing. And Durham is like, so she denies it. But also, here's what happened July, August, September, and October that happens to all be directly related to the campaign and what they were funding and Fusion GPS contacting this reporter and that reporter. In other words, you'd have to be a complete idiot to think that this whole thing wasn't like 100% Hillary. If I could just add one little thing here.
You can add anything you like.
my first story arguing against the Russia collusion hoax was published at the Federalist on October 31st, 2016. I loved that Durham did the same thing I did, which was to look at all of these stories about Russia, all dropping on the same day, all seeming like an info op from Hillary Clinton. And that was my argument, and that's his argument. And it was just kind of nice to have that confirmation from someone who had greater access. I mean, for kind of, if I may, you know, pat myself on the back, that I did it the day it happened, I think is impressive.
It was not an easy thing to do for you. And obviously I was there with you and I saw, you know, the attacks on you and all that. But even later in 2017, I think I wrote a story like, stop, you know, like maybe we should just listen to Devin Nunes a little bit. Like maybe this isn't crazy. Like there is no reason to just dismiss it and not investigate. And the blowback for just saying something like that of me being a Putin stooge and, you know, what all the stuff from like all these lib journalists, it was, you know, and it's a bit scary because you don't want to come out on the wrong side of a huge story like this. It was the, you know, but as it turned out, this was the most successful political, you know, disinformation operation that's ever happened in American history.
If we can point out too, again, Brennan briefs Obama and Comey in July 2016 that the Russians say that there's this info op going to be coming out of the Hillary Clinton campaign. Like, they knew that early. They knew, therefore, that, I mean, at the very least, they knew the Russians believed this to be the case. So any information that was coming was so obviously Russian disinformation, or highly possibly Russian disinformation. Turned out that Christopher Steele was contracting with an actual Russian dude who had been investigated by our own intel services for being a Russian spy, who had bragged to all of his friends that he was, you know, former Russian intelligence, who bragged about being involved in military operations on behalf of Russia, who had asked some of his colleagues at the left-wing Brookings Institution if they would like money for revealing secrets to Russia. Like, this is the guy that was Christopher Steele's primary source. And our intelligence agencies were so idiotic, they opened an investigation on him like 10 years prior, but closed it because they believed he had left the country. And he had not.
Well, thanks for bringing up John Brennan. You know, he knew from the beginning, and that's why it was so difficult, because you had these people lending their considerable credibility. This is the former director of the CIA saying there's something there. So a normal person, and not anymore, of course, but in those days would say, wow, the former director of the CIA is saying there's something here. The director of the FBI is fine with this. Like, these are people, you know, who have incredible knowledge that you don't have and have credibility. But the problem was, Brennan, we now know, knew not only then, probably from the very beginning, but also knew later when he admitted that, behind closed doors, that he knew there was no conspiracy. Yet that same week, I think it was, went on Joe Scarborough's show and said, there's more to it than Mueller's leading on. There's definitely more to it. There's a collusion. He lied. He's a complete liar who belongs in prison. Now, when I wrote this column this week that John Brennan belongs in prison, I got a lot of blowback for it. He belongs in prison for other reasons as well. He spied on the Senate and all that. He's just an odious person. But how about instead of prison, not promoting people who did this? Like, that would be a good start for me. Or not putting them on TV anymore, or not celebrating them as some sort of heroes of democracy. That would be a good start for me. It doesn't have to be prison. I'm willing to start anywhere.
I also don't think it has to be prison, but I'm going in a more extreme direction probably than you are. but yes, at the very least, nobody should be talking. Like, every single time these people talk, it should be announced, this person lied about Russia collusion in a way that damaged the country. This, you know, in the case of Brennan and Clapper, you have other instances that they have lied to the country in ways that were very harmful to the Republic. But our corporate media actually reward the people who participated in the hoax. They themselves were co-conspirators in the operation. I'm never actually 100% sure if they're co-conspirators or if they are literally the stupidest people on earth and actually believed this fantastical tale of Russia collusion.
I think it depends on the person, and we don't need to go through the whole list. But it was funny that the New York Times had, I think, four byline stories saying there's nothing to see here. And one of the authors is Charlie Savage, who was participated in the hoax. So, of course, the hoaxster says he doesn't think anything is there. I'm like, can you get another person who didn't fall for this to write about it, at least in your newspaper?
Right. And I think he knew he was falling for it. So that's not quite the right term. But Charlie Savage, I remember, was really critical of the Nunes memo. Even after the Inspector General report came out, completely confirming the Devin Nunes memo. Once again, with the Durham report, you know, so the Nunes memo had like 5 points, and one was that the dossier was used to secure the FISA on Carter Page. Another was that they had failed to include exculpatory information. Another was that Bruce and Nellie Orr were more involved in this operation than had previously been known. And there were a few other things. Every single thing that was in that memo has been, to say it's been confirmed is an understatement. It was actually so much worse than what Devin Nunes' memo said. And I also want to point out that when the Nunes memo was coming out, the Department of Justice authored a letter saying that if the American people were to read this memo, it would harm the country. And I had said at the time, I thought that what they meant was that the FBI would be embarrassed. And that was absolutely true. The person who authored that letter is the special counsel supposedly investigating for Joe Biden for his mishandling of classified documents. The guy who was also the same guy, I forget his name, the special counsel, was one of the few people who understood that Christopher Steele was who he was and that he was compromised by his relationship with the Clinton campaign. This is the guy that Merrick Garland says will do a really good job investigating Joe Biden's, you know, 5-decade career of mishandling classified information. Sure. Sure, buddy.
The Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski. Every day, Chris helps unpack the connection between politics and the economy and how it affects your wallet. Are you at risk of losing your job to AI? Although some jobs will be eliminated, more jobs could be created. As the fears of artificial intelligence grow, will creative destruction work in this decade? What should you do to prepare? Whether it's happening in D.C. or down on Wall Street, it's affecting you financially. Be informed. Check out the Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Joe Biden was also informed about Hillary Clinton's plans to paint Trump as a Russian asset. And yet later he went and basically agreed that the election had been stolen by Putin. So, but, you know, no one seems to care. But let's talk a little
bit. Yeah, I'll also say the office of the vice president is mentioned early on in the Durham report, you know, meaning Joe Biden, mm-hmm. then vice president. The day after Hillary Clinton supposedly authorized this operation to destroy Trump by calling him a Russian stooge, top foreign policy aides to her campaign were trying to get help from the office of the vice president to just get things out into the ecosystem or to get information. So they were early participants in the hoax.
Who are early adopters. The funny, it's not funny, but it is sort of funny that, you know, of course the reaction from the left is exactly what you expect. It's either to ignore it or pretend that, oh, there's nothing new here. No one's even indicted, you know, no, he couldn't even find someone to indict. It's amazing how this story has gone from the elected president of the United States is actually a Russian spy to, hey, they couldn't even find anyone to indict for this hoax, right? Like, I so much has happened since 2017, but the hysteria this country went through, I have in my 20 years of writing or talking about politics, maybe 9/11, which was an actual event, nothing has matched that kind of hysteria and anger and, you know, I don't even know what to call it. It was just this collective hysteria. And we were talking about it every day and none of it was true. And every stupid story that came out had to be chased down. Do you remember like a story would drop and everyone would get hysterical in the media and like for 2 days and usually it would like fizzle out, but it all made its way into the consciousness of the voter. If you remember, I think it was by like 2019, 67% of Democratic voters thought the Russians had literally tampered with their votes, not bought some Facebook ads, but changed their votes. It is such a success. This was such a success. Yeah, and no one has been held accountable and no one ever will. No one's going to jail. No one's going to be indicted. I don't think anyone's going to be held accountable for this.
Just think it's worth like pointing out too, from 2016 on, the book Shattered mentions that Hillary Clinton is devastated by her failure to win the presidency. And within hours, she and her brain trust are meeting in Brooklyn, and they decide to lean into this Russia false claim that they had made. And they use that to try to keep the electors from voting for Donald Trump. There were lots of legitimate stories about how maybe Donald Trump wouldn't be inaugurated. The day of his inauguration, one of the major co-conspirators in this, the Washington Post, published a piece saying that it's time to impeach Donald Trump. So they run this whole like years-long overt campaign to say that Donald Trump stole the 2016 election by colluding with Russia. They knew it was false. They weaponized it. They got it into the, you know, idiots at the FBI who were eager co-conspirators. They talked about it at length, and they used it to undermine the will of the people who had just elected a new president. It was used to keep people from serving in that administration or to oust them if they did. It was like a full-on coup that was quite successful to undermine that. And you put by comparison what happened in 2020, which involved a radical shift in how we do elections in a very short period of time without buy-in. You know, there were all these changes to laws and processes under the cover of COVID that were just pushed through without legislatures weighing in on them, which is what the Constitution requires, to enable a flood of like tens of millions of mail-in ballots at the same time that scrutiny of those ballots was like brought to nearly nothing. You had the private takeover of government election offices by Mark Zuckerberg spending $419 million in the blue areas of swing states to take to gin up, get out the vote efforts for Democrats. You had the suppression by big tech of major media stories like the Hunter Biden and the Biden family corruption stories. You had our corporate media, which had just engaged in a 4-year long Russia hysteria thing, also inventing, like just making completely made up stories. Like the Atlantic completely invented a story that Donald Trump had disparaged dead World War I soldiers, a story that was refuted by like 25 on the record sources. And so that's the situation going into the 2020 election, where Trump loses by an even smaller margin than Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. And when people are upset about it, the media are like, you're not allowed to ask any questions. You're not allowed to say the words rigged or stolen. You know, like all of a sudden it was just, you know, on a dime, a complete 180 switch where they went from adopting the most absurd theory in history and then saying you're not even allowed to like notice that big tech, you know, interfered in the election.
Yeah, election denialism, which has been a Democratic hobby since 1980, right? But you're not allowed to ever talk about it.
I'd say particularly since 2000, you know, yeah. The last election that they even came close to accepting that they lost would be 1988.
But I don't even want to dive into this now too deeply, but there was a story recently in the New York Times about how the 1980 election was actually stolen because Reagan sent agents over to the Middle East to tell the Iranians to keep holding onto the hostages, which would have been released before, and then Reagan would have lost, and then the world would be a better place, right? It is interesting, though, that now, since then, I mean, you could sort of retroactively see this, but now you can see these things unfold, these operations unfold from like 10 miles away. For instance, the dark money concerted effort to smear and destroy the Supreme Court is one of these sort of efforts that everyone is involved in. But the Hunter Biden laptop story effort was very similar. You had the former CIA guy, I forget his name, Burrell maybe, you know, cooking up talking points for Joe Biden, enlisting people again who have credentials who you're supposed to trust, like John Brennan, to sign a letter that it reeked of had all the characteristics of Russian disinformation, the New York Post story, which incidentally had more corroboration and journalistic ethics behind it than any Russia collusion hoax story, mostly
all of them put together
with their one sourced, you know, leaks. And to interfere in an election, to interfere in free speech and debate using giant corporations, using the people from the CIA and FBI and so on. It is just, it's far more dangerous to democracy than January 6th was. It's not even in the same realm. It is. I've never said these words that I'm about to say in my life. I don't think, not sarcastically. Worse than Watergate by any conception. This was worse. This was a soft coup on the government. They basically tied up the duly elected president for 4 years with this nonsense. How many investigations were there into this? How much money did they spend? How many tens of millions of dollars did they spend? And in the end, Devin Nunes was right about everything and Adam Schiff lied about everything. You know what I mean? And Adam Schiff's going to be the senator from California running the country. It is really.
It's like what Harry Reid said about lying about Mitt Romney's taxes. And then when he was confronted on it, he said, well, it worked. I mean,
you know,
it worked.
Funny you mentioned that. Yeah, I thought about that the other day. That is an encapsulation of what these things are about. And I see these, I don't want to mention all these reporters. We call them out by name all the time, but they are not upset because it worked. They're happy that it worked. They're fine. They want a one-party state. I'm not saying like the average Democrat walking around in Cleveland wants a one-party state, but these media types, these journalists, these pundits, these people in government, they want a one-party state. The only thing they don't run is the Supreme Court. They're going to destroy that as well. And they're happy when the FBI does this because they think they're on such a moral high plane that whatever needs to be done is fine.
So there's one.
Boy, I'm just ranting about this because it upsets me. But I think this is like, to me, I don't know how you come back from stuff like this because I just don't know how you come back from it.
Just one additional thing that I think relates to this, which is when the Russia collusion hoax started, I think most Americans who aren't crazy just thought it was stupid. You know, the theory was put forth by Washington, D.C. media that the reason why Donald Trump had won was because he had colluded with Russia to steal the election. That was, you know, Hillary Clinton and her allies in the media. I think a lot of Americans said, I think he won because we didn't want to vote for Hillary and we voted for Donald. We liked his ideas better. So immediately, like just middle America was like, this is stupid. But in DC, it was incredibly difficult to fight against this. And I would go on these panels on TV and the latest story would drop. And of course we would talk about it. It's not like the Biden corruption story. Like, we've got actual government documents that are on the record showcasing Biden family influence peddling. Do we talk about it at night? I don't think we talk about it that much, right? Like, I don't think many media outlets are really paying much attention to it at all. But it didn't matter how absurd the Russia story was, we talked about it. And so every time I would talk about it, I would get all this pushback from other people that, you know, mockery, anger, derision, you know, like sniping. And now that it all has come out once again as being like that, you had to be a freaking idiot to believe this stuff. You do not see a lot of apologies from these people who were so disdainful of those of us who were skeptical about this Hillary Clinton operation.
My favorite formulation is, I'm happy it wasn't true. I'm happy he wasn't a spy. Like, you know, oh, I'm happy Brett Kavanaugh is not a rapist, like I said he was before. Or, you know, this is good for the country. You know, they do this all the time. They're doing it now with the Supreme Court. I just think it's a good example, though, you know, is that they throw out accusations and it sort of becomes the accusations, though never proven, become embedded in the way they talk about everything. Like, all these ethical problems we've been wrangling with, you know, yeah, you made it up. And then they're like, oh, no one trusts the Supreme Court. We have to reform it. Yeah, because you destroyed trust in the Supreme Court. You destroyed trust in the FBI. You destroyed trust in the CIA, in basically every institution. And now we trust no one. And that's where we are right now. I don't know. I guess it's all big picture stuff. But, you know, I think a lot of Americans, I think you're wrong, by the way. I think there was a contagion there's sort of like conspiratorial contagion on the left. And I think tons of people believe that there was some Russian.
I should have been clear. Yes. A majority of Democrats to this day, I think, actually believe the 2016 election was stolen to this day. That's how effective the lie, the election right. denialism was. What I'm talking about is what we experienced in DC, which is that you would have, you know, all of these liberals on TV pushing the Russia collusion hoax. You have like a limited number of slots for people who aren't openly on the left. Most of those slots were held by never Trump idiots, like just straight up, not very bright idiots. They also pushed the Russia collusion hoax. So what I'm saying is, if you're talking to like conservative America, they're all like, this thing sounds crazy. But it was very difficult for those few of us who were not never Trump like madmen to say, I don't think this sounds right. There was so much pushback. I mean, extreme pushback in places that there should not have been pushback, including, by the way, one time I briefed the Senate on the Russia collusion hoax, and Mitt Romney himself like attacked me because he thought he believed it. And he thought basically like Trump deserves this, which is what I heard one of these Never Trumpaloo pundits say just this week, like, okay, well, it turns out I was wrong to trust Comey more than Trump, but he deserved to have people lie about him and claim that the election was stolen and be subjected to 4 years of a soft coup. So that's the level of thinking you get from the idiots that run the Never Trump movement.
Well, apparently, you know, I'm an idiot because someone will quote, I'm an idiot and tweet it out, David Harsanyi. I am an idiot because I actually, you know, I care about process and stuff like that. I think it's more important than actual issues sometimes, you know, how we deal with issues, how we debate, and all these norms people and process people, they didn't care at, they didn't give one whit about anything to do with process. None of the, almost none of those Never Trumpers really cared because none of them care right now about this. But, you know, so I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker because I care about process and I think it matters. And I'm just a sucker because no one does anymore. No one.
David, we have so much we have to cover. We have to move on to the, what's the next thing you're going to talk about?
Oh, we're off the Durham report completely.
Don't you think? Okay. Do you have more to say? Say it.
No, I like ranting because I don't talk to anyone all week. And this is where I come to rant. Let's talk a minute. Let's talk for a second, just very quickly about, because we've covered this Hunter Biden investigations and what's going on with that quite a bit. But there was a whistleblower, I believe, this week who says that the Biden administration had replaced maybe the entire team at the IRS that was investigating Hunter's, you know, financial doing, you know, the stuff he was doing, the whole family's stuff, apparently.
Yeah. So there had been reports of a whistleblower at Treasury who was aware of very significant information that he wanted to tell Congress about, but he was worried about violating his own requirements not to reveal information. So he went through like a very formal whistleblowing process and he got approval to give some information to his attorneys and to Congress. And this week we learned that he was retaliated against. In fact, his entire team was retaliated against. They were all removed from this Department of Justice investigation that is like the longest investigation in the history of mankind. Like the dude is on tape breaking laws. He's got paperwork up the yin yang of how much he has avoided taxation and stuff. And the Department of Justice is just, gosh, they couldn't be kinder. It's almost Hillary Clinton-like how gentle they're being with this guy. But the whistleblower was retaliated against. He was removed. He and his entire team were removed from the investigation. So, which is not supposed to happen and is a violation of whistleblower protections.
Hunter Biden lied on, like, we know he lied on his background check form for a gun, right? And why isn't he being prosecuted? I don't even understand. Like, I don't care about Hunter Biden. Like I said, I care about Joe Biden. And I think I want to know if Joe Biden got any money. There is tons of circumstantial evidence pointing in that direction. But I still don't understand why he hasn't been prosecuted for gun crimes, for tax crimes, Hunter. I mean, it's clearly there's got to be some interference in the federal government.
Drug and sex issues in there, too. But mostly what people are interested in, I think, is the influence peddling. And this person I correspond with had this great point about how easy it would be for the Biden family to just make all of the news go away, which is just explain why every member of the Biden family, except for the dogs and the four-year-old daughter that they refuse to acknowledge her existence, why is every other family member at the receiving end of wire transfers from foreign governments? I'm sure there's a perfectly sensible reason, right? If nothing bad is happening, they could just say, yeah, no, the reason why we're all creating shell companies to funnel money from these foreign oligarchs is fill in the blank. You can't even get the people in the White House press briefing room to ask the question. But
has anyone asked asked the White House press secretary or Biden, or has anyone asked him about this?
Just a quick pet peeve, since today is day of ranting. It enrages me.
Every day is a day of ranting.
To just remember every single day of the Trump administration featured not one, not two, but like 400 journalists screaming at any possible member of the Trump administration. They were just hysterical every single day. They were rude. They were dismissive. They were antagonistic. They never accepted any answer. They were just like rabid hyenas. And then now we have this subliterate, frankly incompetent press secretary who does not appear to have any education whatsoever. And they're like, Miss Crin, may we please ask you a gentle question? And then she'll yell at them in response, and they haven't even asked anything tough. And instead of even having one billionth of the hysteria that they had under Trump, they're just like all the meekest, mildest. It's like they all had frontal lobotomies on the day that they walked into the White House press briefing room. Not all of them, but like 99.9% of them.
Like, she keeps saying with this debt ceiling debate that the Republicans need to do their job and lift the debt ceiling. And no one's like, yo, they passed a bill and lifted the debt ceiling. Like, no one challenges her.
Real quick point on that. I think it's under noticed that Joe Biden completely caved on his stance. So for months, he said, I'm not going to negotiate with these people. They're hostage takers. They're never going to raise the debt limit no matter what. So I'm not even going to bother negotiating with them. So a few weeks ago, Republicans did it. And finally, earlier this week, he announced that he's sending in a negotiating team. I mean, he totally caved. He had to cave, but.
Yeah. Today, they brought up the work requirements for Medicaid, and he didn't dismiss it. Like, he didn't say, oh no, that's never going to happen. He just sort of went around it, and even Chuck Schumer was talking about negotiating. So I think the Republicans on this issue have done a good job, though. Sometimes I'm like, we take these smallest little victories, and really it's not that much. There is no spending cut. It's going to be 1% hikes in spending every year. And by the way, they're never going to stick to this. Like, just like they didn't stick to that Boehner Obama deal, they'll just spend money. But because you were talking about all the way the press treated Trump in comparison to Obama, let's talk about the CNN town hall, which happened the day we recorded last week, so we didn't get to speak about it. I just want to say a few things on it. Just three quick points. One, it was entertaining as usual. The thing that people, I think, underestimate about Trump is that he's actually quite entertaining, even when he's saying things, that you don't like or whatever. He's just fun to watch. Two, he is completely unafraid of doing interviews with people who are antagonistic to him, which I actually have argued with you about. I think is a good thing. So that part's also entertaining. And the third thing was what was her name again?
Caitlin Collins.
Okay. She did what they always do. Oh, that's not true. I have no problem with an aggressive press, by the way. I just wish they were aggressive against everyone. But if you're going to say that's not true, come with some facts, challenge him specifically. They don't do that. They're just like, oh, you're just a liar. Oh, you're just lying. Oh, you're just lying. And Trump does a good job. And he is, it made me recall that during his presidency, he was maybe the most open president of modern times. He literally answered any question. He literally answered it from all kinds of antagonistic journalists all the time. I think it was a mistake for him because he was not, very disciplined in his answers. But, you can't even compare it. And yet, here we are again with the press just doing what they always do with the new president whenever it's a Democrat.
Okay, so I also agree it was entertaining. And I was thinking about how this left-wing censorship industrial complex that we have, the one that has been trying to silence or remove from any platform any effective conservative voice, had done like a pretty good job of getting Trump off the airwaves, off of, he kind of like went away. It made his appearance at the CNN town hall almost seem like the opening of his presidential campaign. And it couldn't have gone better for him in the sense that, he can be kind of exhausting, to put it mildly. And it was like oddly refreshing to have him back on the scene, just saying things directly in a way that so few politicians do. And I'm not saying like I agree with everything or anything like that. But yeah, it was very, I don't know, it was just It's like the time away from him had served him well.
The refreshing is the right word. Now, I know that this is not the word that most people think of when they describe Trump, but I will say this. Here, it's a visceral thing. Like, you're like, these people are complete hacks. They've hacks. They're constantly being dishonest. And this guy, they deserve this guy. They deserve this guy to say that you're a terrible person or whatever he said to her. Like, he is treating them like they treat us. I think that's what a lot of voters see. And they like that because they're sick of being pushed around. Now, I know everyone thinks they're always losing in politics, and sometimes they aren't and sometimes they are. But he is the only person who goes on there. Maybe DeSantis will do it in the future or whatever. But he's the only person who regularly goes on there and treats them the way they treat voters.
So what I want to say about, I know what you're saying also about how you like that he will go into the lion's den. And I agree with that. When he does it, the problem is he also talks to these corrupt reporters when he has no control over the situation. So he could say something to a Maggie Haberman type who was a participant in the Russia collusion hoax. She actually won an award for her participation in that. You should not talk to people like that. There's no reason, unless you're completely in control of the situation, and he just like rewards these idiots and then they write stupid stories. And also, he's not as prepared as he should be when he goes into some of these discussions. So what I like about Ron DeSantis's handling of this, and Ron DeSantis does not have the skills of a Donald Trump on this. I'm not saying he does, but his media team operates, I think, at a very high level. They are well informed in why they're not going to talk to different people. They are very specific about reminding people of their errors and their falsehoods and their lies. And Ron DeSantis does a really good job of pushing back, like in the moment, on the lies. He's very well informed in a way that inspires trust. But
yeah, I mean, I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that I like everything Trump says or anything like that. I'm looking at it purely as just a spectacle, and why it got good ratings, why the next week CNN's like behind Newsmax in audience, and when he's on, you know, they're doing well. I look at it in that way. And I agree with you as well. He has this weird, I don't think it's weird. I just think it's the world he's in. He has this weird need to be liked or have a relationship with these big media reporters that doesn't serve him at all. All they do is attack him. But for some reason, he likes to talk to them. I don't know why he does that. I don't think
okay.
that's necessary.
I just want
to
do.
So I agree. When you control the situation, if you can have an interview, if you can tape it yourself to make sure things aren't taking it out of context, I think being out there is a good thing, because I think the conservatives, at least if you believe in what they're saying, have good arguments to make. Sorry.
I want to just also touch on some of the ostensibly Republican pushback to this town hall that I thought was worth noting. So the first is, I saw that it was like John Sununu and Larry Hogan, those types of people, they were really upset that the audience agreed or like laughed when Trump mocked E. Jean Carroll. And they were like, and I think even like Matthew Continetti, who's normally, you know, at least has like is sensible about these things. He kind of suggested that this was not appropriate, that these are very serious things that happened with E. Jean Carroll, and that you shouldn't make fun of stuff like this. And I would just say to these people, how are you supposed to, like, why not mock Democrat claims of, you know, Brett Kavanaugh being a serial gang rapist? I don't think like, mockery is the least that should be done. You know, Byron York wrote an excellent deep dive into how this entire E. Jean Carroll thing was a left-wing plot as one of the many legal efforts to, you know, Putin style remove Donald Trump from political life. Even this left-wing crazy New York jury did not find that her claim that he had raped her plausible. And I mean, even just hearing Trump talk about it there, she claims that when she was in her 50s, in a Bergdorf Goodman public space, she was raped. Like, I think it's okay to mock this.
Yeah, people who falsely accuse others of horrible crimes should be destroyed in every way possible. I mean, that's just it. I don't know, though, in this case, her story did not sound plausible to me. I did not like take a deep dive into it or anything, but if Trump didn't do it and doesn't believe he did it, he has every right to mock her. She seems like a crazy person, right? I mean, I've seen her on TV, so, but you know,
a crazy, but incredibly well-financed by the left person. And I mean, yeah. So certainly if you believe that Donald Trump in a public place raped a 50-something year old woman, if you believe that, as apparently, I mean, even the jury didn't believe that, but they still held him like responsible in some way for defaming her.
It didn't make any sense to me.
The decision made no sense. I have no doubt it will be appealed, and who knows what will happen there. But like, if you believe it, that's fine. But don't gaslight the rest of the country into being like, you shouldn't make fun of that. I'm sorry. Like,
listen, if you
I don't accept Democrat claims of sexual assault after decades of experiencing how well-founded they are.
No one undermines the seriousness of sexual assault and rape than people who use it as a weapon to hurt people they disagree with in politics or something. I mean, those are the people who are really undermining the serious nature of sexual assault, not someone who's mocking some woman who's making up a story. I don't know.
Okay, so another thing that I saw these same type of people say is that Donald Trump was a Putin stooge or something. Because Caitlin Collins asked him to say the magic words, Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. And if he could just say those magic words, then everything would be okay. And he said, I actually don't think that's like a smart way to build to resolution. Like once you start saying stuff like this, then it's harder to go into peace talks, which is a very wise and statesmanlike thing to say, not very common in our political class right now. And then these Larry Hogan, whatever Sununu types were like, he loves Putin. Or when she said, will you just say the magic words that you want Ukraine to win? He was like, I want the war to end. I want people to stop dying. Again, very statesmanlike, a statesmanship that we have been missing in our political rhetoric since this war began. And they are, I don't know, they're just clowns. It's like virtue signaling, who, no matter how destructive this war is, no matter how much it puts the entire world at risk of world war, like if you just say these magic words, then everything's okay.
Yeah, I have no problem with what he said in that regard, other than I'm going to fix this in one day. I mean, that kind of like in my
you don't believe it will be fixed in a 24-hour period.
No. I do not believe it will be fixed in a 24-hour period, which is a very sort of New York way of speaking. Yeah, I'll get this done in a day. No worries. But overall, just say, you know, I just don't think the president should be speaking that way. I think it's different for us. I do want Ukraine to win, but I feel like it's already kind of won. So I don't know what the point of this war going on is. Anyway, I don't want to get into that topic.
Oh my gosh. Well, no. Okay. Yeah. I know. I feel like.
That's fine.
But you feel Ukraine has won the war with Russia?
Well, I feel that they've repelled Russia in a serious way and that now this is a good time to start talking to try to deal with the situation. What does winning look like? No one ever tells me. Is it taking Moscow? Is it arresting Putin? I don't understand when the winning happens.
So I think the general definition would be what I've heard people who are big supporters of us like risking World War III to support Ukraine here is getting all Russians out of Ukraine at the borders from the 90s.
It's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. But I, you know, as I've been wrong about many things related to this, including like I did not expect Putin to come in so hard at the beginning. I think the fact that they kept him out of Kiev, kept the Russians out of Kiev, is like great. I mean, that's like a great opportunity to be like, okay, we know we've got some issues here, but they haven't. They both could negotiate to an end, but
I don't fashion myself
could be so hardline.
Yeah, I don't fashion myself some expert on this, but it seems to me like Putin's prestige has been incredibly damaged. The Russians have been unmasked as a third rate power, basically. I just don't know how continuing this war indefinitely helps anyone. So
I'm sorry, David. That's what I never, these people say these things that don't even make sense. That they'll say, okay, so Putin's army is the worst army in the history of the world. And also,
that, yeah.
No, I'm talking about these people who are big supporters. Yeah. Putin's army is the most incompetent, like weird, awful force in world history. And also if we don't give hundreds of billions of dollars more, he's going to take Poland. You know, it's they don't really make sense on.
This happens with all the time. And this will be my last comment on this, where I am supportive. I'm supportive of Ukraine. I think that Russia was the aggressor and all that. And then the argument becomes so stupid that you feel a need to point out that actually Ukraine is not defending democracy. It isn't even a very good democracy at all. In fact, it's one of the most corrupt countries on earth. Or, you know, no, Russia was not going to march into Berlin and Paris. They don't want to do that. They can't do it. It's ridiculous and all this stuff. But yeah, the longer war like this goes on, the more danger there is of pulling others in, of something terrible happening, of, you know, all you need to do is read a history book to know this, of any kind of conflict that's ever happened. So I thought Trump's answers are fine on that. I have no problem with it. Listen, there are a lot of other things we needed to talk about, but I'm going to skip them and get right to culture because I actually watched a bunch of stuff and I'm also talking about politics.
Let's hear about it.
I watched a show called Jury Duty, The Premise.
Oh, because so many listeners had recommended it to you. Okay.
That's exactly only reason I did it. So everyone, the judge, the jury, everyone on the jury, everyone in the courthouse, everyone is an actor except one guy. And they sort of subtly make it just an insane place. So very quick scene. The guy's like, an actor says to the real guy, you know, like, how do you get out of this? I really want to get it out of jury duty. So he mentions a Family Guy episode where Peter pretends to be a racist. So the actor pretends to be a racist. He goes, I'm racist. Like, I can't, because the judge says, why can't you be on this jury? He goes, because I'm racist. There are a lot of, you know, African-Americans and so forth. So they're like, no, I was just kidding, whatever. But so they do a lot of crazy stuff, and it's a pretty funny show. I watched a movie called A Man Called Otto, which is based on a book called A Man Called Ove. Now, I
hate Tom Hanks. I hate him.
You just stepped on my line. I hate Tom Hanks. I cannot stand his voice. I cannot stand his acting. I think he's one of the most overrated actors in American history.
He's like a parody of himself.
Yeah. The movie was okay. Like, if Tom Hanks doesn't make you ill, you could probably watch it. I didn't hate it. There's some stuff in there you would hate. I would not recommend it to you. I saw the movie called Air. Have you heard about this?
I've heard. What is it again?
Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Jason Bateman, a bunch of other of these type of actors about the Air Jordan sneaker and how they got Michael Jordan. Listen, it hits the right spots for someone who like was a kid in the 80s. And, you know, if you like that sort of thing, it's not too deep. You'll probably forget it in about 5 minutes after you're done. And then finally, I would mention that I have started reading a great book by Quentin Tarantino. Oh, I think it's called Cinema something. Damn, escapes me. But he goes through the movies he loves from the 70s, which I have writing down and I'm going to watch, like The Outfit, The Getaway, things like 70s movies that he liked. And it's a really good book. And if you're a fan of Quentin Tarantino's movies, I would highly recommend it. He's really blunt about like directors and movies he likes and what he doesn't like. And he insults movies sometimes that most people are beloved, like Heat, like he thinks the ending was terrible and stuff like that. So it's fun if you're a cinephile, right? And that I think is it. Go on now. Let me hear from you. Anything?
So there's something that we had been watching for a while that I was too embarrassed to admit, but we're done now. So I can just share my shame, which is this TV show called The Night Agent. Have you heard of it?
I have not heard of it. No.
Mark said it was like a show for people whose lips move when they read. Like it was just like a stupid detective mystery, but like you could figure out things, not just like before it was revealed, but like four episodes before it was revealed. You know, that's the bad guy. Here's the twist that's going to come. But for some reason, I felt compelled to watch it anyway. Recommend it necessarily.
For people whose lips move when they read, that's not anything I've heard. Now, the funny thing about that is I read really fast. So I've lately tried to move my lips when I read so that I read every word rather than sort of skipping over. So I have to stop doing that in front of Mark Hemingway.
Yeah, also, that's just not a good way to read. I mean, I speed read and if you're slowing down to articulate.
No, but if you read literature, you should slow down. That's what someone told me.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
Yeah, I speed read too.
We also started The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the latest season. So it's okay. And we watched a movie with the kids that I hated. I don't know how to say this director's name. Is it Sukor or Kukor? George Sukor?
Probably Sukor. It sounds Hungarian, actually. That means sugar in Hungarian, yeah.
Oh, I thought it meant sugar in Czech.
Are those might too, related? Yeah.
Okay. So it was well done. It was Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. It was from 1938. And the people were all so immoral. Or just like, it's like a guy is engaged to marry this socialite whose dad is very wealthy. And as it comes out that he doesn't really want to go into the family business, he wants to just travel and find himself. It literally uses the phrase find himself, or like find myself, in 1938. And so the socialite daughter ends up rejecting him. And then the Katharine Hepburn, spoiler alert, Katharine Hepburn character runs off with him. But I was like, told the kids at the end, it was like, nobody in this movie was good. Like, these were really bad people making really bad decisions and not understanding what responsibility means. Okay. And then I am continuing reading my Bible, which has been so awesome. I just really enjoying this. And so
no spoilers.
So a lot of people had said something about getting bogged down in Numbers. I did not find Numbers to be, it was actually one of my favorites that I've read thus far. I'm now in Deuteronomy. I'm only like maybe 15 chapters in, and it's a lot of repeat of the previous few books. So I'm not loving that quite as much, but it's nice. Like, it's a nice summation of what we've done before. But I don't know. I just have really enjoyed reading it the way I'm reading it, where you get everything in context and you start to get this, like, I don't know, I'm really enjoying seeing the relationship between God and his people and how they interact with each other. And I don't know, it's been great.
That's great. That's it. Been busy.
I wanted to see Jury Duty, and Mark Hemingway said he didn't have any interest in it. So that's what I'm up against. The trailer made me laugh. Like, it was so stupid, but it made me laugh.
It moves somewhat slowly. At least I have only watched a few episodes. I mean, it's funny, but it's not like, you know, I also watched something else that just hit me. I watched a stand-up comedian, Nick Kroll. Uh-huh. It was pretty funny.
Oh, I did. We also watched the John Mulaney. Is that his name?
Yeah. Special. What do you think?
I kind of agree with what we'd published at the Federalist about it. It was not my favorite. He seemed to still be sort of enamored with his addict life. And it was just, I don't know. He's on a journey. I wish him well. I did like that he kind of made a point to reference that he wasn't really able to dig as deep as he should. You know, when he tells the story about how he told his accountant not to give him money so he wouldn't do the drugs. Then he pawns a Rolex, and he says something at the end like, keep in mind, this is a story I'm willing to tell you. Right. Which I thought was like a nice bit of honesty about how bad addicts get and how the stories aren't actually so charming as pawning a Rolex.
So. Yeah. I didn't love it. It was hard for me to put my finger on what I didn't like about it, but I think it was that he still seemed enamored with that lifestyle and didn't feel like, I don't know. It didn't seem maybe earnest, or no, it didn't seem sincere enough in some way. I don't know.
I was a little worried about him, but you know, who knows? Maybe he'll improve here in the days to come. Also, you need to tell everybody about the picture that you showed me right before we started this.
So as you know, I moved to an undisclosed, but more nature-y, foresty sort of area, right? So now I have run-ins with all kinds of wildlife, owls and stuff. But now my neighbor sent me a picture of a snake, and it's huge, and it looks like a cobra to me, basically. I don't know. And then he told me, he told me it's a black adder or a hognose snake, which is very venomous, which concerned me, you know? But then he had then he told me these words. He said, it is venomous, but it isn't interested in attacking human beings. Like, he has any clue what the snake is thinking, or that the snake told him, yeah, don't worry, I'm only going to bite deer or something. It is horrifying, the snake. So I might have to move back to some kind of city area. And listen, I've seen a giant black snake in the back before, but someone told me it was a rat snake.
Which they're fine.
They're fine.
I'm terrified of snakes, but I'm not worried about like those rat snakes.
Yeah, I'm a little worried.
The
but anyway,
picture you sent looked like you were in a South American jungle, and that it was like, I mean, it had that flare out at the neck, which is always like cobra, I know that's not good.
Ugh. Yeah, so I'm concerned about that. But you know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do about it? Nothing. So I'm hoping that an owl will eat it. I don't know if owls will eat a snake that big. I don't know. Every time I mention an animal is here that I don't want to be here, like lizards where I live, mm-hmm. which I didn't think there would be lizards here. Just want to point that out. And they're pretty big. They tell me some other animal will eat it. Like they'll say the hawk will eat. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, there are a lot of bugs here. And they're like, well, don't worry. The mice will eat it or whatever. And then they're like, oh no, the lizard will eat the mouse. And then they're like, the hawks will eat the lizard. And then the snake will eat the, like,
real so circle of life you've got going.
It's a big circle of life. But at the top, I think, is the giant venomous snake, that picture I sent you. And I don't think anything's going to eat that thing. So I'm concerned. But, you know, I saw the other day too. I couldn't believe it. I'm out on my driveway and there's a giant snapping turtle just walking across my driveway. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wanted to move it. And then they're like, I wouldn't put my finger near like its head. I'm like, it can't reach all the way back here. They're like, no, it can pop its little head out really far. So I took a shovel, I lifted it, and I took it back to safety.
Okay.
I can't imagine anyone on earth wants to hear these stories. So I'm sorry and I apologize. But it is pretty crazy. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Yeah.
But I know we need to go, but since we get such amazing feedback from listeners, we have to tape a couple of these where I'll be traveling. We should do a, you know, question and answer one where people send in questions and we answer them. What do you think?
Sure. So we're going to take a sort of a little break for the summer, right?
There'll be a couple weeks at some point in the summer where I can't do this.
Right. So you're saying we should have people send us Q&As on anything they want, like anything. Yeah. Doesn't mean we're going to answer all these questions, but it can be.
Yep. We're going to answer every single question.
I'm going to send in a few for Molly myself. I want to know more about her life, but you can also, and you can send them to radio@thefederalist.com. And hopefully we'll get at least a show out of it. Maybe we'll get two shows out of it. And ask anything, movies, what your favorite band was growing up. I want to know all these things about Molly, so please send them. Maybe I'll make some.
They're all going to be questions of you. Yeah. No, okay, great.
All right. I love how you wrap me up. All right. Anyway, we look forward to talking to you next week. Until then, be lovers of freedom and angels of the prey.